Physics World.
Hello and welcome to the Physics World weekly podcast. I'm Mateen Durrani, and in this week's episode, we'll be discussing the science of the sun. Hearing from a space physicist about the launch of Europe's solar orbiter, and we'll be looking at how to create great acoustics for buildings. But first up, we're turning to the topic of names in physics. Now, all of us have probably dreamed at some point of coining a new physics phrase, but there's one new physics term in the spotlight after a group of scientists complained about a new word used to describe the fact that a quantum computer can solve problems faster than a classical machine. That new word is quantum supremacy, which some people think has unfortunate links with the term white supremacy and should therefore be replaced with something else. Now, to discuss the idea further, I'm joined by Michael Banks, Physics World's news editor, who commissioned an article in the February issue of Physics World from three other people who want the name quantum supremacy changed. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Mateen.
So let's start with the basics. So this term, quantum supremacy, where does it come from? What's the backstory?
Well, quantum supremacy was introduced to represent the ability of a quantum computer to solve problems much faster than a conventional supercomputer could. So in the past decade, we've had 10 years of research on quantum computing. And you may remember in 2009, that was actually our breakthrough of the year, which was the work done on kind of getting multiple components of what makes a computer onto like a single device. So that was our 2009 breakthrough. And then 3 years later, the theoretical physicist John Preskill.
He's at Caltech, isn't he, in the States?
Yeah, he's at the California Institute of Technology. He then coined this term, quantum supremacy, which was then to represent, something a quantum computer could do that would be, beyond the capabilities of a classical or, classical computer.
So it sounds sort of trying to explain the fact that a quantum machine can be so much better. It's supreme. It's a supremacy. So why has all this come to light now? There's been some people unhappy, haven't there?
Yeah. So in late last year, at Google, they announced work on their 53-qubit quantum computer that managed to kind of tackle a specific problem in a few minutes compared to, what it would take on a classical computer would be like 10,000 years.
So much, much longer.
So much longer.
Google's device was a lot quicker.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, that result was contested by IBM. A few days later, they came out with some work showing that actually that one of their supercomputers could do it in 2.5 days. But still, that represents, 2.5 days to, a few minutes. That's still kind of a big difference. So Google could still claim quantum supremacy with the machine.
Yeah. So the actual sort of technical thinking behind the term is sort of quite clear. It's one machine's faster than another one, but obviously it's been problematic, hasn't it? That link with the word white supremacy. So what's the story there?
Well, that's right. I mean, the word supremacy, and it's often used to signify an ideology in which like one social group dominates another. And then it's often frequently used together with white, white supremacy. And of course, that's kind of quite a loaded, political term. So many people, don't like that being used in the field. And, language, to some extent, it does matter. The term quantum supremacy, even makes a single individual feel uncomfortable, then you could claim, that it's worth changing.
But I mean, John Preskill, he didn't deliberately use that word with any sort of underhand motivations in his mind, did he? It was just an adjective that perhaps he, I don't know, had he not thought about the consequences, or he just thought that was the sort of the best adjective to use to describe that?
Yeah, I mean, he said that he did come up with other suggestions. One was quantum advantage, for example. He did stick with quantum supremacy because he thought that it did represent, the vast ability that a quantum computer can have over its classical counterpart.
So there were three people in particular, and they wrote a comment in Nature, didn't they? They wanted the name changed. And then you got those three people to write about this in more detail in the February issue of Physics World. So who were they again? There were three sort of, they worked at quantum startups in the UK, wasn't it?
Yeah, so the three protagonists, and sorry if I get the pronunciation wrong here, were Leonie Miurek, Karen Palacios Bellacuru, and Dia Persaud. who, they wrote a letter in Nature, saying that quantum supremacy should be changed to quantum advantage. And they also penned an open letter, which has been signed now by around 300 people, saying that quantum supremacy should be changed to quantum advantage. And then have now also written this opinion piece, which is in the February issue of Physics World and also available to read online on our website.
So obviously they're not happy with the words quantum supremacy, but do you think that quantum advantage will catch on? What has the rest of the community been saying about this? Has there been much reaction, or is this just three people who feel very strongly, but it's kind of... you said 300 people had signed the letter, so has it had much impact?
Yeah, it's not sure at the moment whether it's had kind of any, impact beyond those kind of people who were directly involved. But there were a few instances where people have actually begun changing the titles of the papers. So there was a few instances last year where a researcher had quantum supremacy in the title of the paper, but then when it was accepted, they actually changed it to quantum advantage. So maybe slowly, this kind of change is kind of happening, but it may take, some years before it actually kind of kicks in.
Because of course, some people might say, this is just sort of the thin end of the wedge. If everyone takes offense at words in physics, where does it stop? What are the names? I don't know. Are there any other potential names out there that might cause offense to people? But who even rules on this? Who decides whether something should change? This isn't a sort of technical term that has a sort of certification next to it, is it? It's just a technical term that I don't know who has jurisdiction over those definitions or those uses. I suppose it's just the community deciding to change it, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess the community has to kind of come together and agree to, stop calling it quantum supremacy and, call it quantum advantage instead. There was an instance in 2008 when the New Horizons telescope space probe that went to Pluto, but it also investigated some of the objects in the Kuiper belt as well. And one of those was called MU69, but it was also nicknamed Ultima Thule.
Oh yeah.
And this was mostly the Latin name for kind of the furthest objects, because it was like one of the most distant objects that's ever been studied. But it also kind of provoked, Nazi connotations to that, because it's the, it's the mythical origin of the Aryan race, is what the Nazis thought.
So that was changed, wasn't it, then, that term?
Yeah, so then that was changed, and that was by the International Astronomical Union. They came together and changed that then to, so now it's known as 486958 Arrokoth, which is actually to honour an indigenous Native American tribe.
Right. So that sort of had a happy ending. Are there any other examples of name changes in physics? The one I can think of was, there's been attempts to sort of change names. I remember when the Higgs boson was discovered. Do you remember that Michael Riordan guy? He wanted it called the Higgson, with a small h, because he wanted a fermion or a boson. He didn't want the name Higgs with a capital H linked to the particle. I don't think that ever caught on, did it?
No, there are other suggestions as well, because of course the other people involved with the theory behind the Higgs boson, they're not in that name. It's just Peter Higgs is, a particle named after him. So there are also other cases where, it could have been the HEK particle, for example, named after some of the other people. But yeah, the Higgs boson seems to have caught on, and that's what we all now use, I guess.
All right, so thanks, Michael. We'll wait and see whether quantum advantage is the name that people choose to use, or whether quantum supremacy continues to be the go-to name. Well, I don't know. Would you like it changed? If you were working in the field, would you change it, Michael?
No, it's a tricky one, isn't it? I think it's what I said before. If it makes one person feel uncomfortable, you could argue that there is a case for it to be, changed. But then again, is quantum advantage really the right term for representing some of the advances in speed that a quantum computer can do? I'm not so sure whether advantage is the right word.
All right, well, we'll wait and see. Well, we're kind of, let's support that case for changing it here at Physics World. All right, thanks, Michael.
Thanks.
And you can read more about these issues in the article Towards a Quantum Advantage, which is in the February issue of Physics World, and it's also available on the Physics World website. So I'm now joined by Hamish Johnson, who's here to talk about the sun. Hi, Hamish.
Hi, Mateen. Yeah, talking about the sun, and unfortunately here in Bristol, we haven't seen much of the sun this winter, have we? It's been very gray and very rainy. So yeah, let's talk about the sun in anticipation of spring.
Well, it's sunny today, isn't it? I just went out for lunch, so there's a bit of sun in the sky.
It is. It's definitely sunny today, so things are looking up. But yeah, the sun. So we've had some amazing images recently from the Anuye Solar Telescope, which is on top of a volcano in Hawaii. And it's just released its first images of the sun, which are very impressive. Have you taken a look at those images, Mateen? There's one on the Physics World website.
Well, apparently they're the highest spatial resolution ever seen of the sun. Is that right? So what sort of resolution are we talking about?
Well, I think the spatial resolution is 30 kilometers. Now, that might not sound very good here on Earth, but you have to remember that the sun is huge.
And a long way away.
And a long way away. That's right. Yeah. A bit of Father Ted there. The telescope itself looks at a portion of the sun's surface that's about 2.6 times the surface area of Earth. And it can resolve features that are as small as 30 kilometers.
And then you get this sort of weird mosaic picture, don't you, of convection cells, don't you? It looks, how would you describe it? It's, a mosaic, I suppose. What's it showing if you look at that picture? What does it tell us?
Well, this is a picture that's taken, I believe, in the infrared, and it shows convection cells, sort of a lattice. Well, it's not quite a lattice, is it? But it's sort of a closed-packed structure of convection cells. And basically what happens there is that the heat from inside the sun bubbles up through the plasma and is radiated away from these convection cells. And then the cooled plasma falls back down into the sun. And so you can see each cell has sort of a bright spot in the middle where it's very hot and lots of heat is coming off. And then it's surrounded by a dark region. And so that's where the plasma, I suppose, is falling back down into the sun. And you can see this in great detail. But what one of the most amazing things in this image is that if you look at these dark bits, which form the boundaries of these convection cells, you can see these really bright spots. These bright spots are where magnetic field lines emerge from the sun. And these magnetic field lines are of great interest to solar physicists. Well, I mean, the sun's magnetic field in general is of great interest to solar physicists because its magnetic field basically defines how it behaves.
So how do they know that magnetic field lines are emerging from where those bright spots are, if it's just taking infrared images?
Oh, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm guessing that it's really hot around these magnetic field lines.
Right.
And that actually could be the solution to one of the mysteries of the sun. And that is why the corona of the sun, so its outer atmosphere, is much, much hotter than the interior of the sun. And I think the idea is that these magnetic field lines are sort of driving energy into this corona and making it very hot.
But yeah, Hamish, we could soon be seeing images from another solar observatory if all goes well on Sunday. And that's when the European Space Agency's Solar Orbiter, that's going to be launching from Cape Canaveral in Florida. So what's that mission all about?
Well, yeah, that's a mission to the sun. It's going to be put into an eccentric orbit around our star, and it will get as near as 60 solar radii from the surface of the sun. And that's significantly closer than the planet Mercury gets to the sun. And it's quite the mission. It has 10 instruments aboard, and these will do measure a range of things. They'll take images of the sun, for example. So, you know, look forward to even more spectacular images of our star. It'll sample the solar wind It will measure the sun's magnetic field and lots more. So very soon we're going to have lots and lots of information about the sun. And
so hang on, within 60 solar radii of the sun. So I guess it needs a lot of heat shielding, or does it burn up, or how long does it last for?
Well, I suppose things will get hot on board. It will do 22 orbits around the sun. And along with NASA's Parker solar probe, which was launched in 2018, we should be getting lots and lots of interesting data about the sun. And you say that the solar orbiter is going to get hot, but the Parker solar probe is going to get even hotter because it's going to be much closer to the sun. So things are heating up in solar physics.
So, we think of the sun as just this big hot ball, but we know the surfaces are, really, really active. And as you said, that activity is linked to the star's magnetic field. And we're just sort of exploring what that's all about. And recently, Physics World's Margaret Harris caught up with Sarah Matthews. And she's Professor of Solar Physics in the Department of Space and Solar Physics at University College London. And Margaret talked to her about what we know and don't know about the sun. And here's a recording of their conversation, which took place at the 15th Appleton Space Conference at the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory in Oxfordshire.
Sarah, what are some of the big unanswered questions at the moment about what the sun does and the physics of what the sun does?
Well, I think probably the biggest unanswered question is what is the origin of the solar dynamo? Because all of the other questions are really related to how the sun's magnetic field evolves with time and on multiple scales from the kilometers to, a solar radius. But actually, we still don't properly understand how that large-scale dynamo that creates the structure that we see in the outer atmosphere and the sunspots that emerge and are very visible on the surface of the sun operates, and also what the role of what we call local dynamo is. So there is different cyclical behavior for smaller scale features in the solar atmosphere than there is for example, the sunspot cycle. And so leading on from that, there are the questions of what it is that actually triggers the energy release that produces solar flares and coronal mass ejections, the origin and acceleration of the solar wind. So we know that the fast wind comes from coronal holes and the slow wind must come from the regions around the equator, where there's a mix of closed and open magnetic field. But actually how the solar wind gets to the speeds that we observe at the Earth is an unanswered question. And I guess the one that still remains and is related to the origin of the solar wind is why is the outer atmosphere as hot as it is? Because as you move away from the heat source in the centre of the sun, the temperature does drop, as the second law of thermodynamics predicts, but then it starts to rise again when you get into the chromosphere and out into the corona. And whilst that has also to be related to the magnetic field and how energy is transported by the field, we don't know the details of that still.
So would it be accurate to say that we have a lot of observations about various phenomena in the sun, but we don't necessarily know what's beneath the surface of those observations, what's driving them?
I think so. I mean, the simulations are very sophisticated these days, and we are able to explain a lot of the observational features in many of those problems that I've just described. But actually, there are unexplained observations which tell us that there is missing physics somewhere in our simulations, and those are the problems that I think we need to solve.
So how are we going to answer those questions?
I think we're going to answer those questions through a combination of new observations which will challenge the theories and the models that we currently have, and bringing together all of these different data sources so we can see inside of the sun. So helioseismology has provided huge advances in our understanding of what the solar interior is like and where we believe that the magnetic field is generated, but we need to bring all of these things together in order to make the biggest progress.
And what are some of the insights that sort of more practical Earth-based insights? I mean, it's fantastic to understand more about what the sun is doing just for the sake of it, but I guess there are some applications as well for...
Yes, absolutely. So solar activity, so the sudden release of energy from the magnetic field in the corona takes a few forms. So one is solar flares, and what solar flares result in is an increase in intensity across the entire electromagnetic spectrum, in fact. So what that means is that we get an increase in UV intensity, in EUV X-ray intensity, as well as in optical and radio wavelengths. The increase in EUV, UV and X-ray intensity changes the density in the Earth's upper atmosphere, so it has an impact on the drag that satellites in low Earth orbit will experience. It also impacts, so X-ray in particular will increase the ionization in the ionosphere, so it impacts directly on radio communications both on Earth and from the ground to satellites. Electrons and protons and heavier ions are accelerated in that process too. Those are damaging to astronauts on the space station, and certainly if we're thinking about sending astronauts to Mars, the radiation associated with flares and coronal mass ejections is a very big issue to solve. But it also impacts airline crew, particularly on polar routes, where there will be an increase in radiation dose. Coronal mass ejections are another way. So these are these big bubbles of magnetic field and plasma that often come with solar flares, but sometimes come on their own. They also accelerate electrons and protons. But when they reach the Earth, if they're Earth-directed, because they carry magnetic field, they have the opportunity to interact with the Earth's magnetosphere through this process called magnetic reconnection. And what that does is to allow plasma, ionized gas, of millions of degrees, traveling at thousands of kilometers per second, to enter into the Earth's magnetosphere and to generate currents which can disrupt ground power supplies. There are some famous examples of transformers being blown out as a result of this. The Quebec hydro electric plant in 1989 is one of the ones that people often cite. So many other things as well.
And I presume the sun is obviously a star and one of billions in the universe, so knowing more about the sun will also tell us about some things would have great difficulty, at least, in measuring, I suppose.
Yes, so the sun really is the only star where we get to resolve processes where they're happening on intrinsic scales. So with some of the new ground-based telescopes coming online in particular, we'll be looking at resolving features on the surface of the sun that are 16 kilometers in size. So yeah, we're really getting down to the scales then where the approximations like of magnetohydrodynamics are actually breaking down, and we're looking at kinetic processes, and we'll never get that on other stars. And so the more we can exploit what we can learn from the sun about these fundamental processes, the more that we can then hope to extrapolate them to other astrophysical objects.
So Matthews, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So that was solar physicist Sarah Matthews speaking to Physics World's Margaret Harris. And fingers crossed that on Sunday that the European Space Agency's solar orbiter launches successfully. I'm now joined by Physics World's features editor, Sarah Tesh. The February issue of Physics World is now out, and the cover feature is all about the acoustics of theatres and concert halls, written by Anna Deming. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Mateen.
Right, so this feature is called Acoustics in Architecture, is that right? What's it all about?
It's about acoustics and architecture.
Right, good one.
Specifically looking at concert halls and theatres and the fact that the space has to be used for a lot of different types of performances and how best to get great sound out of that space.
Right. So I don't know about you, but whenever I go to a theatre or concert, normally I'm really sleepy because it's dark. But I mean, do you notice the acoustics a lot? Are you sort of big on, ooh, that sounds horrible, that sounds good?
I think I notice when it's bad, but I don't notice when it's good, because in that instance, you're so like immersed in it that you just don't really notice because it's the entire performance and you're really kind of engaged. But when it's bad, I do notice it then.
So in the feature, Anna looks at two performance spaces in Bristol where we're based. So there's the Bristol Old Vic, which is a theatre that's recently been renovated. And the other one is the Colston Hall, which is a concert hall that's being renovated right now. So have you been to either of those?
Yep, I've had the pleasure of going to both. Bristol Old Vic I went to recently, actually. So I hadn't seen it before, I hadn't been in before the renovation, but I've been in the new space. Been to the actual theatre itself, but also the little cafe area, foyer area, which they had to do a lot of work on as well.
Because the foyer is really strange because it's got it's really quiet acoustics in the foyer, but it's also been designed that so that if there is a band or a concert in the foyer, the acoustics work really well then as well.
Yeah, they've managed to somehow get it to be a very private area so you can sit and have like a nice little chat with your friends, just like nice and quietly. But then at the same time, have really surrounding sound when there's a concert happening in that space, and it's like very multi-purpose, and they've used different like acoustic tricks of the trade kind of to get that. So like, for example, they've kept the old back wall, which is where the performance would happen in front of, so it would just back it, but because it's so pockmarked with age and everything, it acts as this really good sound diffuser to send out to like the crowd who would be in the rest of the space. But then at the same time, because they've kept all the old lines from, because it's a 250-year-old space.
So you can't just take a bulldozer and renovate it so it sounds great. You've got to pay attention and care to the building.
Exactly. So it's full of all these like unusual angles, like irregular. It's not all kind of very parallel beams and everything. And that just means that the sound gets reflected in a really good way, and you don't get kind of like sound heavy spots. And the architects have been able to use the fact that this very eclectic space can actually create this really nice sound, right, or lack of it when you're in the cafe. You don't hear other people's conversations.
So the other venue in the article that Anna Deming talks about is the Colston Hall. So that's being renovated, and that's that shoebox geometry, isn't it? Which is really popular among acoustics people.
So the shoebox geometry is when you get the long high ceilings and that give like plenty of space in front of the musicians or the performance, and then you get a really rich sound over the rest of the audience, and there's like less space behind the musicians, the performers, and so they get, there's less sound lost behind it. So Colston Hall is not as old, I don't think, as Bristol Old Vic, but it has gone through a fair few renovations itself, including one in 1951 where they renovated it after it became victim to a cigarette, which burnt it down in 1945. So it has managed to survive the Blitz.
Survived the Blitz, but got burned by a cigarette.
And so in 1951, when they were renovating and everything, they introduced the canopy above the stage so that the sound would get reflected back to the musicians and they could hear themselves. But over the years, the stage has been made bigger, which means that if there was an orchestra performing now, the string musicians at the front of the orchestra wouldn't be covered by the canopy. So they wouldn't hear themselves. They wouldn't be able to hear it and everything. And also it apparently kind of rises at the front of it, which means you get these weird reflections. So one of the things that they're doing in this renovation at the moment is they're trying to extend that canopy so it actually covers the rest of the stage so that the musicians can hear themselves no matter where they are.
Right, right. And the article also talks about vineyard-shaped concert halls. So that's not a shoebox. That's more like, I don't know, how would you describe it?
It's like a... So it's, It comes from the concept of the fact that if people were listening to music informally, they gather in like circles around the musician. Right. And they would just surround the musicians, like if you were on the street listening to somebody. And then, so it worked on that. And I think it got introduced in Birmingham Philharmonic first. And like, and it basically it acts like a bit of a vineyard, and it just kind of like terraces that are surrounding it. It has its negatives, like the fact that it can be very directional sound. So if you're sitting next to the trombone section or something, you're just going to hear that kind of thing. But it has got some popularity,
So it's weird. I always think concert halls are weird because it's like simple physics, but everyone is different and you can't really create a sort of standard concert hall.
It also has to look good.
They also have to look good,
And some like some places have to have, they have so many different types of music happening, and it has to be able to accommodate for that, or if it's theatre versus a gig.
And it's even things like the materials the chairs are made of, the cushions and all that.
And curtains as well, because curtains are very good at absorbing unwanted sound.
Right, so one thing in the article that Anna mentioned was this top 10 list of the world's best concert halls. And I've got the list in front of me, so we're going to have a little quiz, who's been to them, and I'm joined by Callum Jelf, producer. Hi, Callum.
Hello.
We're going to see how many of these all three of us have ever been to. Right, so number 10 in this top 10 list is the Mayerson Center in Dallas, which is a shoebox. Been to it? Yes?
No. You?
No. Number 9 I have been to. This is the St. David's Hall in Cardiff.
Yes, I have been there. Yeah, so Mumford & Sons there.
Mumford and Sons.
And Ramesh Ranganathan, but I'm not sure the acoustics quite meant for that.
Sarah?
No.
And that apparently is a surround hall.
I've seen the outside of it. Does that count?
Yeah, count you in. So cool. 1 out of 2. Number 8 on the list is the Culture and Congress Centre in Lucerne in Switzerland, which is a shoebox design.
Again, no.
Sarah?
Again, no.
Feeling very uncultured now.
Yeah, I have a feeling that I'm not going to be doing these.
Right, this one is my favourite. It's number 7, Symphony Hall in Birmingham, where I'm from. So I have been to that many times, and that's a shoebox.
Nope.
I thought I had, but then I asked my mother, and apparently no.
I know the acoustics there is fantastic, because even a rustle or a cough can echo around the... But it's wonderful. It's very well designed, and looks good.
What gig did you see there?
Classical concert.
Of course.
On to number 6 is the Stadt Casino in Basel. A shoebox, again. Callum?
No, shoeboxes seem very popular, though.
That was built in 1876. Sarah?
No.
Have you even been to Switzerland?
I lived there for 3 months, if that counts.
It does. Number 5 is in Japan. It's the Tokyo Opera City Hall, which is another shoebox hall, and it opened in 1997. The picture looks brilliant. I've never been. Callum?
Yes.
You have?
No, I haven't.
Sarah?
Is that the one which has to accommodate all the different types of traditional performances? Am I thinking of that right one that's in the feature?
Probably, yeah. I don't know. It's getting too technical. Number 4 on the list of the top 10 concert halls is the Konzerthaus in Berlin. It's another shoebox hall. They're very popular. And that was from 1821. After getting damaged in World War II, it reopened as a concert hall in 1984. Callum?
No, I haven't been there.
Sarah?
No, I haven't. Have you?
Nope. I have been to Berlin.
Yes.
Yeah, I've been to
several
Berlin.
Times.
If we're just counting the city now, that count? I'm going to do a lot better at this.
All right, number 3 is the Concert... I'm not going to pronounce it properly. Concertgebouw in Amsterdam. That's another shoebox hall, which opened in 1888. Looks wonderful. Sarah?
No.
I might have seen it.
No, not been there. Apparently, it's got 1,974 seats. So number 2 in the list of top 10 concert halls is Symphony Hall in Boston.
Oh, I have seen the outside of that when we were at the APS last year.
And that's a shoebox hall, 1900. It is the most noble of American concert halls, says Bruno Walter.
I was just about to say.
You've not been there?
No.
Right, okay. Do you even know what the top concert hall in the world is? Anyone, any guesses, Callum?
Sydney Opera House?
No.
I reckon Vienna.
Yep, it's the old Musikverein in Vienna. That's the place where they always do the New Year's Day concert.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
On New Year's Day. And that is another shoebox hall, and it opened in 1870. And Bruno
that
Walter.
It's very grand looking.
It is, yeah. It's the finest concert in the world. Have you been there?
No. Alan? But I have seen it on TV.
I've seen it on TV.
So I think between us, we've been to about three, four?
I think we've been to.
I think we've been to two and seen a lot of outsides.
Oh, many an outside.
So yeah, that's the list of top 10 concert halls. And
Shoebox was very popular then.
Shoebox is popular.
Is Shoebox for all of them? Is
all that, but is one,
that,
I think.
Oh, okay. That seems to be the go-to.
Yeah, the Vineyard's not got great marks. From
not
the,
really kicked off as much, has it?
Sour grapes, I think.
Very nice.
So that's all for this week's podcast. Thanks to Hamish Johnson, Sarah Matthews, Michael Banks and Sarah Tesh. And Callum Jelf, producer, for stepping in at the last minute with our little chit-chat about concert halls. If you like what you've heard this week, you can subscribe to the Physics World weekly podcast via Apple Podcasts or another podcast app of your choice, or follow us on Spotify. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.
Physics World.